Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along. It's great to have Herb Keenan here tonight. I'll introduce him briefly. He's worked as a journalist at Israel's major English language newspaper, the Jerusalem Post, since 1986, and during that time his roles at the paper have included those of Jerusalem reporter, immigration reporter, and religious affairs reporter. And he was appointed diplomatic correspondent in 2000, the year of the Second Palestinian Intifada, and he continues to report for the Post on this issue. Now, for decades, his round as defence correspondent brought Mr. Keenan into contact with Israel's political elite, including the various prime ministers. And in November, for example, last year, he travelled to the United States to report on the proceedings and outcomes of the Annapolis summit meeting, which was convened by President Bush. Now, our speaker, of course, is on top of all these issues, but he also writes for the Jerusalem Post on the topic of the trials and tribulations of life in Israel. So rather than address specifically the national security issues, we thought we'd invite him today to talk about the trials and tribulations of life in Israel. And before our speaker starts, I should thank Colin Rubenstein and others from the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for making it possible to have Mr. Keenan here tonight. Herb Keenan, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me here tonight. The lecture is entitled The Trials and Tribulations of Life in Israel, or in other words, a brief on the current diplomatic and political situation in Israel following the war in Lebanon, on the way to an agreement with the Palestinian Authority, in the wake of Hamas's takeover of Gaza, in light of the breached border with Egypt, in the face of the Iranian nuclear march, in the shadow of political uncertainty in Israel, in light of Ehud Olmert's colon cancer. That's a lot. That's a lot just to say, and it's a heaping dose of trials and tribulations. I live just outside of Jerusalem in a community called Maale Adumim, and we had a guest speaker in my synagogue a few months before disengagement from Gaza in 2005. He was a rabbi, and it was a Shabbat morning, and he said that people are always asking him what will be. People are always coming up to him in his community and saying, what will be? What's going to be with the terrorism? What's going to be with the Palestinians? What's going to be with the process? Where is it all going? What's going to be? He said one man was driving him crazy day after day. He said, took him to the side. He said, look, we're Jews. As Jews, we believe that in the end, everything will work out, right? In the end, there'll be redemption. In the end, there'll be peace. In the end, everything will be roses. Your problem, he said, is you were born in the middle. And I think to a large extent, that does indeed sum up our situation. We are very, very much in the middle. We're deep in the middle. That's part of the trials and the tribulations. But also, honestly, it's part of the exhilaration of living in Israel. Being part of it, being part of the historic processes, is at once maddening and frustrating. Yet at the same time, it's also oftentimes invigorating. The disengagement from Gaza, the rise of Hamas, Iran's march towards nukes, is fundamentally altering the country's strategic situation. Right? Transformation is in the air. Transformation of the region, transformation of the conflict, and transformation of Israeli society. And transformation is oftentimes unsettling. The transformation that I want to concentrate the most on, and which in my mind explains a lot about what's happening, is the transformation of the society. The Palestinian violence that began in September 2000 has fundamentally changed and altered Israeli society. The nation that to a large extent embraced the Oslo process as the harbinger of a new dawn in 1993 is not the same nation that is warily, very warily, eyeing what can now be called the Annapolis process and the negotiations taking place with the Palestinians over the core issues. Something happened, right? Something happened in Israel, and that something has a name, and the name is terrorism. In order to understand Israel today, in order to understand so many of the government's actions, it's necessary to understand the strain and the pressure that everybody, has been living in with in Israel since September 2000, since the beginning of the Second Intifada. This is a critical subtext in understanding the entire story, and it's a subtext, unfortunately, that doesn't come out across abroad. Government policy generally runs in two directions. It runs upwards and downwards. What does that mean? It means sometimes the government comes up with a policy and it filters down to the people, and other times the people have an idea and it filters upwards towards the government. Disengagement from Gaza in 2005 was an example of an idea that started with Ariel Sharon, which, because of the force of his personality, he was able to push through the government, through the people. But the idea to build a security fence in 2002 is an example of a policy that began at the bottom and worked its way up. Because in 2002, it was the worst year of terrorism we ever faced. The people felt insecure. They felt that they needed something, and they wanted the government, against Sharon's initial feeling, they wanted him to build a security fence. In a small country like Israel, what this illustrates is that in a small country like Israel, what the people feel subjectively in their guts has a huge impact on policy. And what the Israelis have felt in their guts pretty much since September 2000 is intense insecurity and vulnerability. And much of what the government has done since then must be seen within the context of alleviating that feeling of vulnerability and insecurity. Right? The experts look at the situation and they explain it like this. They say, look around the world and you see various conflicts. Right? Some countries have conflicts from within their own borders. Spain with the Basques, Russia with the Chechens. Right? Other countries have border disputes or problems with their immediate neighbors. India and Pakistan is a good example. Other countries have a problem or a threat, feel threatened by long-range ballistic missiles. Right? Russia and the U.S. Israel is facing all three threats simultaneously. Right? It gives new meaning to the concept of a chosen people. Right? We're facing all three of these things at the same time, and this is a unique situation in the world. And these threats are not something theoretical, not something out there just on the textbook. These are immediate threats that the people on the street feel on a daily basis. I can describe the situation like this. You have suicide bombers knocking on the window. You have Hezbollah in Lebanon trying to kick down the door. You have the Iranian president, right, threatening to blow up the whole house, right? And that's the mindset in which the people, the average person on the street, is dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And it's important to understand that mindset in order to understand what the government's doing. I've lived in Israel for 25 years. I lived through the first Intifada and the second Intifada, the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War, the first Lebanese War and the second Lebanese War, and I never felt a sense of insecurity, right, or a fear for my own security like I did from this period of 2000 until 2005, 2006. One of the paradoxes of life in Israel, right, I'm sure many of you have been there, but one of the paradoxes was you could walk the streets of the city. This was a country of war. You could walk the streets of the city at night, right, in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, at 9, 10, 11, 12 at night, and you'd feel secure. You'd see little kids walking around, right? Yet it's a country that was war. This was a paradoxical situation. Unfortunately, we lost. This is one of the feelings that we lost as a result of the Intifada. It used to be I was in Israel. Everybody goes into the reserves. I was a combat medic in the reserves for 15 years. And I used to always serve in the north. I would serve in the Lebanese border, and I would serve in the Golan Heights on the Syrian border. And I come from Denver, right? I originally come from Denver. I don't come from a great fighting family. My father was a clerk typist in the Korean War in the Air Force. He used to joke that when the enemy came, he'd backspace. So this was kind of my mindset. And what happens in Israel is you get a call-up notice in the mail, and I get nervous, right? I get nervous. They send me to the borders. The borders are dangerous places, right? Terrorists infiltrate through borders. Terrorists kidnap soldiers on borders. Rockets fall on borders. So I'd be worried about my own security. The last time I went to Milouin, the reserves, was in 2002. Since then, thank God, I've been drummed out because of old age. But when I went in 2002, I was on the Golan Heights. I was right on the border with Syria, and I was hunkered down in my bunker. Right, and I had on a helmet and a flak jacket and a rifle. I felt secure. I was worried about my 13-year-old daughter who had to take a bus from where I live into Jerusalem. And that's how the whole security equation, psychologically, in people's mind, has been switched around. In this environment, it makes it a real challenge, and this is also something that doesn't come across. It makes it a challenge to raise kids. Right? You want to give them a carefree youth, like I want to give my kids the carefree youth that I had, but it's difficult to do so. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. I'll give you my own personal example. I have four kids. My oldest boy now is 8 months in the paratrooper unit in the Army. His entire adolescent life was lived under this shadow of terrorism. Right? He lived, thank God, he lived a pretty normal, had a pretty normal adolescence. But it was a struggle. It was a struggle because he'd always want to go. He'd want to go into Jerusalem. He'd want to go into Tel Aviv. He'd want to go to the Kinneret and Tiberias. He'd want to take public transportation. And you say, no, 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 you can't go until you can't say no anymore because he's going to go. So you let him go, but you do so with a kind of sick feeling at the pit of your stomach where there's a parent, you're doing the right and the responsible thing. Now this terrorism, right, shaped his attitude towards the world. To a large extent. The fact that he went into the elite unit that he went to and went into, I think, is a direct result of what he saw growing up. Now, again, I don't want to paint a completely dark picture. He also had fun as a kid. But still, you had this cloud hanging over his head. My daughter, she's now 17. When she was 14 years old, she came up to us, my wife and I. She said she's afraid to take the bus. Right? So what do you say? Honey, don't worry. Nothing happens. Now, you can't do that. But yet the kid's got to take the bus. Again, as a parent, it makes it very emotionally, you know, you have mixed feelings. I have another son who's now 14, and I live at the end of a wadi, a beautiful wadi down below. There's goats and sheep. It's very pastoral. It's a paradise for a kid to play in, but the kid can't go down there because you don't know what else is at the bottom. And then finally, I have a sixth grade boy who, before we go on vacation, so ask if we're in the range, if the vacation spot is in the range of the Qassam rockets or the Katusha rockets. And he wants to know that. That's the reality that they're growing up in. Again, you chisel out a normal life for them, but you have this always at the back of the mind. During the worst of the violence, you know, we try to insulate the kids. I'm a journalist. I'm a newspaper man. I get three newspapers delivered to my door every day. But certain times during the height of this, I'd run out to get the papers before my younger kids could see them. I didn't want them to see the papers. I didn't need those images, right, of the bodies or the suicide bombers. I didn't need those images indelibly etched into their mind. But you can't insulate because the violence and the terrorism was all over. Right? Again, from 2000 to 2005, it was everywhere. And it also makes it a real challenge to raise kids, and this is something people don't comprehend either. It makes it a challenge to raise kids in this environment who simply do not hate. Right? I come from a liberal American family. My kids say things around the dinner table that I can't believe are coming out of the mouths of my kids. Right? But they're being raised in a completely different environment than I was. And I try to combat it with the same mantra that my mother would say, right? You know, you can't judge all people, not all Arabs want to kill you, not all Palestinians want to throw you into the ocean. But when you're dealing with kids who are 10, 12, 14, and 16 years old, right, it's a hard sell because they see the world in black and white shades. As parents, we struggle to keep our kids from being consumed both by fear and by hatred. And it's not always easy. And it's made more difficult because the terrorism is real, right? It's not an abstract. It's not happening there on the television screen or beyond the border's edge. It's happening to people in your neighborhood. I'll give you my own example. I live in a very average apartment building. There are 12 apartments in my building. The guy I bought my apartment from was killed in a terrorist attack. My first cleaning woman, a Russian immigrant, was killed in a terrorist attack. My next door neighbor's nephew was hurt badly in a suicide bombing attack in Petah Tikva. And the first cousin of a neighbor upstairs, a soldier, was killed in Hebron. A co-worker of mine at the Jerusalem Post was hurt badly in a suicide attack. The terrorism was everywhere. It crept into your life, and it shaped the way you looked at everything. The way you looked at the world, the way you looked at the government, and what you expected by the government, what you expected the government to do. For example, when Ehud Olmert decided to go to war last July, right, to get back two kidnapped soldiers, he did so under the influence of a public opinion that expected and even demanded that he do so. Now things look differently, but in July 06, there was massive support for going to war over the kidnappings. Why? There's a context to it. What's the context? A week before these two guys were kidnapped, Gilad Shalit was kidnapped, right? A week before that happened, an Israeli boy was kidnapped north of Jerusalem. He was kidnapped and killed. 2 weeks before that, there was an attempted kidnapping of two Israeli girls. So there was a sense among people, right, that we were at the cusp of a new wave of terrorism, that something dramatic had to be done to stop it. This touched a nerve. It reminded all Israelis of their own vulnerability, because those kids could have been anyone's kids. And so there was a massive sense that something dramatic, drastic, needed to be done to keep these types of kidnappings from becoming a weekly occurrence. Now, for outsiders, also for people who live in Israel, it's often difficult to understand why the government now, for instance, is talking about giving up 450 terrorists in exchange for Gilad Shalit. But why? Because everybody there has a kid who they think could, God forbid, one day be in a similar situation. And if that was the situation, they would want their government to do the world, to give up the world in order to get their kid back. Right? That's, again, it's a small country, and these things are felt intimately by everybody. Now, why do I say all this? Because it's important not to underestimate the country's sense of vulnerability in dictating policy towards the Palestinians, towards the Syrians, and even towards the Iranians. Now, I want to touch briefly on each of these concentric circles. I want to start from the outside and work in. I want to start from Iran and work inward to the Palestinians. For roughly the last decade, right, since Israel has been concerned about Iran's nuclear ambitions, its policy has been guided by the following premise. Iranian nukes are not only an Israeli problem, which needs an Israeli solution, but rather an international problem, which needs an international solution. While very active diplomatically in trying to stop Iran, Israel did not jump out in front and take the public lead. The Iranian president was keen in getting Israel to do so, right? He was interested in framing this issue not as Iran against the West, not as Iran against the U.S., but as Iran against Israel, as Islam against Jew. Why? Because if he could do this, he could get certain countries who are as afraid of his nuclear potential as we are, such as Saudi Arabia, such as Kuwait, off his back. Right? If he could frame it as an Islamic Israeli issue, then he would get them off their back. And he's been able to do that to a large degree. He's been successful at this. Only in this context can you understand his oftentimes what sounds such to be ludicrous comments about the Holocaust and about Israel. They're ludicrous on the surface, but they do what he wants to do. He wants to set this up as Iran against Israel. What happened, though, at the beginning of last year, we began to see a shift in Israeli policy, and Jerusalem was taking a more upfront role, right, on the whole issue. The policy changed because while the diplomats were talking, the centrifuges in Tehran or around Iran were spinning. The policy changed because countries like Italy and Germany, not only Russia and China, were slow getting on board the sanctions wagon. The policy changed because the U.S. National Intelligence Estimate gave Jerusalem a sense to a certain degree that when push comes to shove, and if push comes to shove, Israel could likely be facing the Iranians alone. There's a growing sense, although not one publicly articulated by the Prime Minister, that the diplomatic track in stopping Iran's nuclear march won't work, and the time is indeed of the essence. Or in other words, Iran's technological clock is working faster than the political clock opposing it. Israel is coming, as it were, out of the closet on this issue, sending signals that military action is a distinct possibility if the world doesn't get into gear. What are the signals? The biggest signal we saw was on September 6th when Israel hit whatever it hit in Syria. Right? This was meant to indicate to the world that while we all might chuckle when the Iranian president talks about sending us to Alaska, we're taking this threat very, very seriously. If you look at recent Israeli history, when Israel feels vulnerable, it acts. It felt vulnerable by the Palestinian terrorism and acted, showing that there just might be a military solution to bringing down terrorism. We brought down terrorism from 435 people killed in 2002 to 11 last year. That's a significant achievement. When it felt vulnerable by wave of kidnapping, we went to war against Hezbollah in the summer of 2006. When it felt vulnerable by whatever was going on in Syria at the time, we acted against it. When the country feels vulnerable, it acts. And the message coming out of Jerusalem is that Iran's insufficiently impeded nuclear march is making Israel feel vulnerable. Now make no mistake about it, right? This is not 1981. Iraq is not Iran. If Israel or the U.S. strikes at Iran, they're going to hit back. You know, they're talking about raining 11,000 missiles down on Israel. That's a bit of hyperbole because they don't have 11,000 missiles, but the intention is still rather obviously clear. A lot has been said about last summer's, or about the war in 2006. A government commission, the Winograd Commission, just issued a report saying that the country was inadequately prepared and did not wage the war either effectively or successfully, all of which is obviously true. But if the war had one positive side effect, it focused the mind on Iran. One of the key lessons that Israel took from the war was the realization that as bad as the situation may be with the Palestinians, as troublesome as the situation is with Hezbollah, they're all sideshows, and the main event is Iran. Israel's internalizing this message. One place you see this is in the decision to focus on developing a multi-layered missile defense system to be up within 3 years to deal not only with the short-range Qassam missiles coming from Gaza, but also the possibility that Iran might send long-range ballistic missiles from their territory. If Iran hits Israel, if Israel hits Iran, Iran will hit back. And it's dealing with how to protect us from their counterblows. Not conventional warfare as in the past, but missiles that the country is now focusing itself very heavily on. Will Israel attack Iran? I don't completely rule it out. When? When it feels that it has this protective umbrella in place, right? And there's a race going on. Do we get this protective umbrella in place before they're able to develop nuclear weapons? Because you have to hit them before they get the weapons. And when you do hit them, like I said, they're likely to hit back with missiles. This brings me to the second circle, which is Syria. One of the biggest fears that followed Israel's inability to roundly defeat Hezbollah in 2006 was that this would embolden the Arabs and show that Israel was not invincible. Indeed, as the Winograd Committee wrote just last week, or just 2 weeks ago, the second Lebanon War was, quote, a serious missed opportunity that ended without a clear military victory. These facts, the committee concluded, had far-reaching implications for us, for Israel, as well as for our enemies, our neighbors, and our friends in the region and around the world. And indeed, it didn't take long for the manifestations of this to come. On August 15, 2006, the day after the war, Syria's President Bashar Assad, seemingly intoxicated with Hezbollah's performance, delivered an extremely bellicose speech praising and pledging allegiance to the resistance and threatening to use the same kind of methods in redeeming the Golan. This was fiery, Nasser-like rhetoric, right? This was essentially Assad declaring new rules to the game following what he apparently believed was Israel's defeat in the war. He essentially said that the status quo had changed and gone back before it was in the Yom Kippur War. Now this change of rules, this new perception by Assad that he was now in the driver's seat, led to the heightened tension for months in Israel on the Syrian border. And talk of a possible war, Israel was really generally concerned that he would be so intoxicated as to do something crazy like to try to march on the Golan. On September 6, 2007, right, Israel, by attacking whatever it was that attacked in Syria, sent the rules back to what they used to be, reestablished the old balance of power. This attack illustrated for everyone the gap between rhetoric and reality. And this was huge for us for a number of reasons. Number one, it restored Israel's deterrence following the war in Lebanon. Number two, it indicated to the Syrians that despite the fact that over the last 3 years they've been on a mad buying spree of Russian anti-aircraft missiles to protect their own missiles, which they want to fire into the Israeli population centers, despite their purchase of these missiles, they were still vulnerable. Israel could penetrate through that system. It also sent a message, an important message to Iran, that Israel could and would hit when it felt threatened. And there's a Chinese proverb that I never understood that goes like this: kill the chicken to scare the monkey. In this case, right, the chicken is Syria and the monkey is Iran. You hit out at Syria in order to scare Iran. Again, you see a situation here where Israel felt its back was up against the wall and took action to relieve its vulnerability. Now this brings me to the Palestinians, right? And the Annapolis process. When looking at the Annapolis process, the first thing you have to understand is that the U.S. has determined that the best solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a two-state solution. Israel now, after many years, wholeheartedly believes. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, also agrees. The international community, to a large extent, wants to see a two-state solution. Then why aren't we going to get there? And I think that most people realize that this isn't going to happen anytime soon. There are a number of reasons. First of all, Hamas doesn't agree. And Hamas, to a large degree, are the ones riding the horse and calling the shots. Secondly, I want to harken back to what I discussed earlier, how terrorism or the fear of terrorism has dramatically altered the Israeli mentality. The conception in Israel that was extant in the 80s, and especially in the 90s, during the Oslo period, that if we merely make the necessary concessions, we can ensure our future in the region. If we just give territory, we're going to get peace back, has to a large extent gone by the wayside because of the last 7 years. The country, to a large extent, went from believing that it could solve this conflict, seriously solve it for once and for all, to a realization that the best we can do, given given the facts on the ground right now, is to manage the country, is to manage the conflict, right? Ariel Sharon's way of managing the conflict was unilateralism. Do what's good for us, get out of their lives, right? Hunker down behind the security fence and let them deal with their own situation. But things in the Middle East don't go, as they never do, quite as planned. Israel left Gaza to the last Jew, but that wasn't enough. Right? Hamas came to power, Qassam rockets continued to fall, an Israeli soldier was kidnapped. What this did was it hammered home to many in Israel the conclusion that unilateralism is simply too easy. That you can't just turn your backs and leave because everything in the country is too close. If there's a fire on the doorstep and you're sitting in your living room, you're going to inhale the smoke. And I think the experience of the last 2 years from Gaza since disengagement has kind of shoved that down the Israeli throat. Right? You look at the situation now on the border between Gaza and Egypt with the breached border. You know, some could say, well, it's not our problem and we don't have to deal with it. But it very much is our problem. Because if the border is breached, then terrorists can go from Gaza to Sinai and then from Sinai back into Israel. So it is our problem. You can't just turn your back and say it doesn't affect you. Now Israeli society, but for the last number of years, Israeli society has been in a state of flux. It tried to negotiate a settlement, that was Oslo, but that didn't work. It tried to unilaterally give up land, disengagement from Gaza, and the withdrawal from Lebanon in 2000, and that didn't work. The dilemma we face is a cruel one. On the one hand, there's a feeling among the majority of the country that the continued retention of the territories and its 3.5 million Palestinians is, in the long term, bad for the country's national security. However, there's also a realization among most that just picking up and leaving, as was done in Gaza, is bad for the average Israeli's personal security. Right? Look at the situation now in Sderot and in the western Negev. The dilemma can be summed up as follows. How do you leave a good chunk of the territories and stay alive? This has been the dilemma, and nobody really has come up with the formula about how exactly this can be done. That's the country's overarching dilemma. Olmert, prodded by the U.S., is now trying a new formula, and that's the Annapolis process. But Annapolis is not only about us. One can argue that Annapolis is as much about the Americans and the needs of the Americans to form a coalition of moderate Arab countries from North Africa to the Persian Gulf as it is in actually solving the Israeli-Palestinian dilemma. The Americans in Annapolis are basing their premise are basing their premises on the following assumptions. The first is that the Palestinian leader, the Fatah's leader Mahmoud Abbas, unlike Yasser Arafat, really does want peace with Israel. Right? That's premise number one. Another premise is that he's too weak to carry out any agreements right now. Another premise is that the status quo, the situation as it is right now, is unhelpful. You can't allow this situation to continue forever. There's another premise that the idea is that the Palestinians see what they can gain by a peace agreement, then they'll get rid of Hamas and they'll grab it with two hands. And another premise is that there will be massive Arab support from the modern Arab world for the Palestinians to come to some kind of agreements. What the Annapolis process is trying to do is dangle out an agreement to the Palestinians and say, grab this agreement and push Hamas out. The idea is to take what's being negotiated now, take an agreement, put it on the shelf, right, and then wait until the conditions are ripe on the ground where you can take it off the shelf and implement the agreement. Because everybody realizes that right now you can't implement it because Mahmoud Abbas isn't in control of the situation. The approach, however, I think has a couple of fundamental flaws. The first is when faced in the past with offers that the world thought the Palestinians could refuse, right? After the Camp David Accord in 2000 or after the Taba agreements a few months later, the Palestinians refused. There's also another problem in that any agreement that you conclude now, even if you put it on the shelf and for some reason you can't implement it, right? That will be the starting point for any future negotiations. This happened to us last in 1993 when Yitzhak Rabin promised Bill Clinton at the time that in exchange for peace with Syria, Israel would be willing to withdraw fully from the Golan Heights. Now, you today try to start to negotiate with the Syrians on any line outside of that one, I think it'll be very difficult. Another flaw here is that the moderate states, the moderate Arab states, Saudi Arabia, is somehow going to get behind this. Saudi Arabia is concerned about Saudi Arabia. The royal kingdom is concerned, the royal family there is concerned about the survivability of the royal family. And making overtures to Israel right now is not something domestically that the Saudis feel that they can do because it's not popular on the Saudi street. There's also insufficient attention hay, primarily from Condoleezza Rice, but also from Olmert. So what do we do with Gaza, right? The idea, it's as if once the Palestinians see the great deal they can have, right, they're just going to grab it and they're going to push Hamas. They're going to push Hamas out, or Hamas might even voluntarily walk out the door. I think that that's at best that's wishful thinking, and at worst it's dangerously naive. Yet this is what's being proposed, and it's a proposal now that brings me to the last thing that I want to discuss, the funnest thing, and that's Israeli politics. Right? Say what you want about Ehud Olmert. One thing that everyone must now concede is the man is a master politician, a master. His survival to this day is the stuff of political legend, right? And one thing that will help him survive politically for the coming year and a half or 2 years until the next election is the impression of a diplomatic process. Olmert has a flak jacket made up of three layers right now. The first is his considerable circle of friends. The man's been in politics for 35 years. He's developed a lot of friends in industry, a lot of political friends, and a lot of friends in the media. The media in Israel right now, to a large extent, is coddling Olmert. His second layer in this flak jacket is a deep anti-Bibi Netanyahu sentiment among many in the country. It's not necessarily that they love Olmert, just they hate Netanyahu, and they will do anything to keep Netanyahu out. The third layer is the peace process. The peace process, as long as it continues, keeps on Olmert's side certain segments of the Israeli elite who, were he not moving ahead with the diplomatic process, would want to push him out immediately because of allegations of corruption and other policies that he has. I was on a speaking tour in the U.S. in November 2006. This was just after the war. Right after they set up the Winograd Commission, I was asked how long I thought Olmert would last, and I said, until the end of 2007. Right? Look where he is, look where I am. Right? I mean, the man is a magic. He's a magician. He's a magical politician. Look what happened in the war. Right? After the war, the chief of staff resigned. After the war, the defense minister resigned. After the war, Olmert is still standing. Because when you're dealing with politics, he can outmaneuver anybody. His only problem, his only danger, I think, right now, is if one of these investigations, a legal investigation into some allegations of wrongdoing, if that sticks, it'll be more difficult for him because he can't outmaneuver the legal field, but he can't outmaneuver anybody on the political field. There's also other unforeseen circumstances that can impact on his political future. He came out in November and he said he had colon cancer. That night, his popularity went something from 35% to 41% overnight. Right? Now, considering that at the beginning of the year, his numbers were 8%, that's incredible. Right? 2 weeks ago, we had the Winograd report. That itself, the fact that he got off pretty easy from the report, led to a popularity boost, with one poll saying that 18% of the country wanted him to be prime minister. Now, that doesn't sound so much to you, right? But a few, 3 weeks ago, that number was 8%. So that itself is also a considerable boost. It's ironic to hear that Olmert say, as he often does, that Abu Mazen is too weak to implement any agreements. Right? That's true. It really is true. But Olmert is also too weak to be able to implement right now any agreements. On paper, he has a coalition of 67. Right? You need 60 to govern. But this coalition is threadbare. And the minute he starts talking about issues like Jerusalem, I think that he'll be in serious, serious trouble. All this underlines two fundamental problems endemic to Israeli politics. The first is an astounding dearth of leadership, right? The second is the country's inability over the last 40 years since the 67 war to determine what it really wants. Regarding the first problem, the dearth of leadership, nothing bears this out more than the comeback of both Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Barak, right? The fact that the two are very much in the center of things politically, after facing resounding losses at the polls, right, is nothing short of amazing. The former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Australian Martin Indyk once described Israeli politics as the land of the weird and the home of the strange. And I think that the fact that these two men are very much in the thick of the running bears this out. Imagine a U.S. campaign, presidential campaign, not featuring Barack Obama against John McCain, but rather one failed president, Jimmy Carter, against another, the first George Bush, right? And I think you have a situation of what we're facing, having Barack and Netanyahu so popular right now, or so much in the running. So how can you explain this? Right? Has the country fallen in love again with Barack and Netanyahu? No. What this shows, again, is the shallowness of the leadership pool. After the war in Lebanon, there was a funny satirical ad in one of the major dailies, Yot Achronot. And after the war in Lebanon, not only was the leadership in trouble, the prime minister, the defense minister, the chief of staff, but the president and the justice minister were facing their own scandals, sex scandals, as it were. Right? So the ad went like this. It said, wanted for a Mideast country, a president, a prime minister, a defense minister, a chief of staff, a justice minister, no experience necessary. And I think that this is as true now as it was then. When you look out at the pack, unfortunately, nobody really sticks out. The other major difficulty facing the Israeli political scene is that we have never decided what we want. Right? If I ask you what the Palestinians want, you can tell me in a heartbeat. At a minimum, the Palestinians want their own state inside the 67 borders with Jerusalem as its capital. If I ask you what the Jews want, you can't tell me, because we have never decided. We've never come to a consensus agreement on our own of what we want. It matters. It depends. It matters what the Europeans say. It matters what the Americans say. It matters. It depends on the Palestinians. It matters. It depends. But depends is not policy, right? You can't achieve what you can't define. Now, we have never defined something as elementary, as basic, as where our border should be. Right? There's a great Middle East theorist. There's also a very good baseball coach named Yogi Berra, who said something once brilliant. He said, don't be surprised if when you leave your house in the morning and you don't know where you're going, you're not going to get there. And to a large extent, I think this sums up our situation. We haven't gotten there because we've never defined exactly where there is. And we go to elections in Israel quite a bit. We've had 6 different prime ministers during the reign of Clinton and Bush, and the count isn't necessarily finished. And each time we go to the elections, right, we wait for that one decisive outcome, that one outcome that's going to allow us to make a conclusive decision, and that never happens. It never comes. Now, don't take this to mean, please, that I think that if we would just decide, everything would fall into place. Because that's obviously not the case. There are other players out there who have a lot to say about the matter. But it would help us a lot if we knew exactly in what direction we were running. Now, after you hear all this, you can say, oi, you know, it's kind of depressing. And when you're deep inside it, right, sometimes it does feel incredibly depressing. But I'm optimistic about the future of the country. And I'm optimistic for 2 basic reasons. And these are the reasons I enjoy living in the country. The first is, and actually when I say this around the table, when I say to my kids I'm optimistic, they say, you know, Dad, you know, everything going on, Iran, Palestinian terrorism, you're not an optimist, you're a moron. Right? But there is what to be optimistic about, and there's 2 major reasons. The first is the country is incredibly resilient. The country is awe-inspiringly resilient. The fact that, you know, through this period of terrorism from 2000 to 2006, 2005, 2006, the country went on pretty much normal. That's quite a testament. It's a testament to the country's resilience. The country has still been able, despite it all, to develop, right, to build a very creative, vibrant society because of its resilience. There was a parliamentarian, a left-wing parliamentarian named Amnon Rubinstein, who in 2003 wrote something very interesting. He described the situation like this. He goes, look, you have a situation of mind-numbing terrorism. People afraid to go downtown with their kids. Right? You have a situation where the reservists, soldiers just like everybody else, are going into Jenin and Kalkilia and doing very difficult duties. Right? And in this situation, the doors are wide open, but nobody's running for the exits. Right? That says something about the strength of the country, that we in Israel, when you're in the middle of it, you don't take that into account. The other thing that I find very uplifting is it's a very problem-solving orientated country. At least for short-term problems, right? If there's a short-term problem, you don't raise your hand and say there's no answer to it, you find a solution. We don't plan well in the long term because we're very much concerned about short-term problems, but you do find solutions to short-term problems. Terrorism is a good example of that, right? I remember at the beginning of the Intifada, people were saying there's no military solution to this, right? There's no way that military, you can bring terrorism down. Well, we brought it down. We brought it down from 435 people killed in 2002 to 11 last year. That's a significant thing. We brought it down as a combination of technology that we developed, right, and day-to-day military incursions into the West Bank. A few years ago, before this all started, there was an Israeli humorist by the name of Ephraim Kishon, and he wrote something like this. He goes, Israel's like a hand, right? If you take a hand and you put it under a microscope, right, it looks horrible. Right, it's ugly, there's veins, and there's hairs, and there's follicles. It's not nice, it's not pleasant. But if you move back a bit, you see that the hand is connected to the arm, which is connected to the body, which does wonderful things, right? And you see, that's the case in Israel. When you're there in the middle of it, you lose sight of everything that's gone on there over the last 60 years. You know, you forget where we were 60 years ago, where we are today, and how we got there. And that's something that I think, and you know, it's called the trials and tribulations of life in Israel. That's one thing that, as Israel approaches its 60th anniversary, it's very important to keep in mind where we were and look at us now. Those are my comments. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
So we come to questions and discussion. So, Anne.
You were saying that Israel hadn't come to a conclusion about where it wants to go, but it certainly unifies around what it doesn't want to happen, the ultimate, its own destruction. To what extent does this keep it going and provide it with the reason it does exist? I mean, without it, would it keep going? Without that panic sort of crisis mentality?
That's
a good question. Can I get you to talk to the end of the room?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a good question. I might have overstated the case. Israel knows one thing, and it wants to remain there. Right? Israel wants to remain as a Jewish democratic country. That's a consensus opinion from the left to the right. Now, it's within that, what kind of democratic Jewish country and where the borders of this democratic Jewish country should be, that's where the argument is about. But there's consensus opinion among the Jewish community in Israel that it wants to remain as a Jewish democratic country.
There's a question here. Yeah.
Yes, I was just wondering, from the Israeli point of view, what do you people think of the war in Iraq and the United States involving the Australian British involvement in European Iraq?
Questions about attitudes in Israel to Iraq and the involvement of the coalition of the willing.
Right. Look, I'm speaking as Israeli now. From our point of view, the war has been a net gain. Right? A net gain. Why? Before the war in Iraq, Israel faced two existential threats. One was from Iraq, right? I mean, we faced the threat of weapons of mass destruction from Iraq, right? I remember in 1990 cowering in my secure room with my kids, wondering if Saddam was going to put on the missiles the same stuff that he sent over to the Kurds. It wasn't a theoretical, it was real, right? It was real. That was one threat. The other threat is Iran. Those were the two existential threats. Now we face one existential threat, right? That's a net plus. That's a net plus. There's another situation. What was the concern? The concern, and this concern is coming back now, but the concern was that Iraq, the irredentist regime in Iraq at a certain point would take over Jordan, okay? And that you would have an Iraqi regime right on your border, right on the Jordan River. Right? That threat isn't the same. It was also in the beginning when the war started. I mean, the feeling was that, you know, if you give the Islamic radicals a big clap, right, you send them on the ropes, that's something that could resonate throughout the region and would also be better for you. That would take some of the wind out of the sails of the radicals who are faced off against Israel. Unfortunately, because the way the war is going, right, they didn't get such a clap, and then to a certain extent, the Islamic radicals are being emboldened by what happens. But the net gain, at least among the leadership in Israel, this is a net gain for us because Iraq was a serious threat and then now is no longer a serious threat.
Question down there, then we go over here. Yeah, Anya.
Mr. Hand, would you say that Israel's young people, having been shaped by all the uncertainties that you've just described, do you think that they've developed their own distinct sort of political identity? And do you think that one day that will come out in Israel's foreign or domestic policy?
That's an interesting question. Look, I look at my own son, right? And he's a younger generation. He's more right-wing than I am. If you look at the polls, right, I'm not right-wing, but he's further to the right politically than I am. If you look at the polls, the younger voters have more of a tendency to vote for the right than the older voters. Again, because they're shaped by this and they don't have necessarily all the intellectual tools to see the various gradations of colors, right? So it's interesting. In Israel, I mean, it might be unique in the world. In Israel, the younger voters have a tendency to be more right-wing than the older voters. It's definitely shaped things, right? I mean, you can't have a situation like we've had over the last 5 years and pretend that it doesn't shape attitudes. One of the big, I think one of the big tragedies of this whole thing has been the relationship between the Israeli Jews and the Israeli Arabs, right? I mean, this used to be something that people would point to with pride and say, you know, there's this harmony between Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs. Unfortunately, this has been one of the casualties of the last 5 years because a number of Israeli Arabs have been implicated in terrorist attacks. And this is something that the people feel. Now, it's also interesting, the Israeli Arab politicians, there's 10 Israeli Arabs in the parliament out of 120. They feel that what's going to get them votes is to speak very stridently. So their tone is extremely strident, right? I mean, you have Israeli Arab politicians speaking extremely stridently against Israel. They're doing that for their own political reason. I understand that. What's the problem? I also hear it, right? And my neighbors also hear it. And so it creates a certain distrust between the two communities that you didn't have prior to 2000.
Question here, then again.
You mentioned your children several times. I suppose they went to school there. Now, how do the teachers or the educational system influence the future of the population of Israel? You know, because here in Australia, it seems that many of the teachers are left wing. So how do the teachers influence the children in Israel?
Look, I mean, it's tough to generalize, right? I mean, you have teachers on the left, you have teachers on the right. I mean, obviously the education they receive is a huge, you know, it helps shape their mind. If, let's say, my kid has a very right-wing teacher, well, then I'm there at home, you know, to kind of balance things out. My problem isn't necessarily with the Israeli educational system. My problem is with the Palestinian educational system. And when you want to know, if you want to know what's going to happen, will there be peace? Everybody says, will there be peace? There will be peace when the Palestinian kids are not educated to think that there's no place in the region for Israel. That's when there'll be peace. When their education changes, right, then I think you can start to have hope. The problem right now is that educational system hasn't changed. And that's the real danger.
What about the teaching of Arab-Israeli kids? Are you happy with that?
I'm not that familiar with it. I mean, the curriculum, it's a government curriculum. It's a government curriculum. There was a big controversy about a year ago about the education minister right now is fairly left-wing. A woman by the name of Yuli Tamir. And she wanted to initiate into the teaching in the Arab curriculum. They refer to Israel's independence as Hanakba, right? The Nakba, the I don't know what that's translated into English. It's the defeat. It's defeat or the catastrophe. It's a catastrophe, and she initiated that into the curriculum because she said you have to, you know, teach them where they're at, and that caused a huge ruckus. But I mean, they do have Israeli curriculum, but it's also designed to a certain degree to, you know, to for them. You know, they're not learning the same thing that my kids learn.
You've spoken about the perception of Israel from within. What saddens me is the perception of Israel from without, the world at large, has deteriorated rapidly. It seems that Israel's lost the propaganda war compared to the feelings of the government, much of the world, of pity, except the poor Palestinians. The Palestinians appear to be the victim in so many areas of the media that we read, and Israel is the horrible antagonist. That's a great shame to get a point on how that can be improved.
I hear this a lot. I mean, I hear a lot of complaints when I speak around about Israel's public diplomacy. It's called in Hebrew Hasbara, that the Hasbara is a disaster. I hear it oftentimes. I speak a lot in America. I hear it from American Jews who their image of a Hasbara success is watching CNN and seeing Bibi Netanyahu out arm wrestle Hanan Ashrawi on the news, right? If he can do that, that gives them a sense of pride. They think that Israel has then done itself wonderful in the Hasbara field. Now, there's something to that, but that's not the be-all and end-all of Hasbara. That's not the be-all and end-all of public diplomacy. What is? The be-all and end-all of public diplomacy is having your narrative accepted by those who matter. Now, I'm not that familiar with Australia. I'm very familiar with the U.S. In the U.S., right, you had a situation where you had an incredibly supportive president, an incredibly supportive Congress, right? A very supportive public, according to all the polls. And even the media If you take out certain newspapers, the mainline media wasn't that bad. The problem the U.S. had to do with college campuses, that's a serious problem. So I think you have to define what is public diplomacy, what's the objectives. Is it to have a spokesman on CNN who speaks well and eloquent, or is it to get your narrative accepted by those who matter? This doesn't have to be mutually exclusive, but I think that Israel does much better on one front, on getting the narrative across, than it does on the other front. Also, if you look at the geopolitical situation right now, right, we're not doing that bad, right? We have, again, Bush is very supportive. Gordon Brown, very supportive. Tony Blair, very supportive, and he's the quartet on envoy. Nicolas Sarkozy, right? I mean, this is a miracle. France is now our friend, a big friend in the EU. This has been a dramatic change inside the EU. The EU used to be divided like this. There was Germany, Britain, and the Netherlands for us in all the forums, and you had France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece against us, okay? France has now moved on over to our side. That's very significant. What's my fear? My fear is this change has been at the governmental level, because the governments get it. The governments are facing their own terrorism. They see what Israel's up against. They get it. The people, it's a different situation. Our standing among the British public is not good. Our standing among the British government is good. To a large extent, I think this is because of the British press, right? But that's the problem. Once they get into the government, they see it. You can see the problems we face. But the people, they see the pictures on the news, right? And they're harsh pictures. They're harsh pictures, and that shapes their images. Israel's job is to try to go beyond the pictures and explain itself, but people don't have the patience to listen. Right? They don't have the patience to listen.
Jin.
Okay. My question is: is there any genuine intention among the within the people of both sides, parts of the ordinary people, Israeli and the and Arabs, that it is time to cease the conflict and bring the bring this peace and order in the region.
And that's a complicated question. Look, I think you've seen something very fundamental happen in the last 15 years. And the conflict, our conflict, has gone from being a territorial conflict, which is solvable, to a large extent to being a religious conflict, a religious ideological conflict, which is much more difficult to solve. If you think back, 20 years ago, right, when you had the PLO was not a religious movement. The PLO was a nationalistic movement. The PLO was a territorial movement. UN Security Council Resolution 242 said exchange land for peace, right? The idea being that if you give up land, you'll be able to make peace. It took Israel a long time to go along with that, but at a certain point, they said, okay, we're willing to do that. We'll give up land, give me peace. We gave up land, we didn't get peace, right? And I think what's changed is the change has been in the Arab community, around the world, right? The rise of Islamic extremism, Islamic fundamentalism has changed our conflict. It's made it much more difficult to solve. And until that changes back to where it was, where this becomes a territorial, not an ideological issue, not a religious issue, then I think it's going to be very difficult. Look, I'm a religious person. I understand the importance that the religious laws have in a person's life. Okay, if the Hamas's interpretation of the Quran is that there is no place in that corner of the world for an Israel to exist because it goes against their religious laws, it's tough to compromise on that if you're a religious person. Okay, so until that changes, I think that it's going to be difficult to solve the problem. Now, that doesn't mean that everything's dim and gloom and bad, because Israel can survive. Israel has shown that it's able to build a very vibrant, dynamic, creative, intellectual society, a good place to live. I mean, I live there not only because I think it's important for Jews to be there, but I live there because I like living there. And I want my kids to live there because they like living there. Right? It's able to do this even as you do defend yourself. And that's, I think, what the country's doing.
Now we're almost coming to the end. Have I missed anyone?
Okay. The second one.
Well, it's going to be very brief. Okay.
Are you satisfied the way the Australian politicians and media represents the problems of Israel?
Well, I think that's a bit hard. He's only been here 3 days. So. I was an expert on Israel, but I was there for 4 days. So. Can I just ask a final question? You mentioned at the end there about your children. You've spoken a bit about your children today. But what do the kids think about the trials and tribulations in Denver? I mean, Do they think that you've taken them into what's a very harsh environment compared with a prosperous city and a prosperous nation where there's very little threat to national security as distinct from where you live outside of Jerusalem where their life is threatened every day? How do you feel about the move that you made a quarter of a century ago? And no doubt you're staying where you are. But
it's an interesting question. I moved to Israel right after college. And I moved to Israel because I thought that it was very important for there to be a Jewish state. And if Jews don't go there, there's not going to be a Jewish state. I mean, that's to sum up my Zionism in a nutshell. Right? It's important that there's a state. Don't take the state for granted. This is one of my big bones of contention with the American Jewish community. They take the existence of Israel for granted. And then we were hit by this intifada, and I think people came to understand, it ain't always going to be there. Right? It might not always be there. You got to make it happen. So that's why I went there. Right? My kids were born there. Right? This is what they know. The geography is what they know. The climate is what they know. The language is what they know. The culture is what they know. This is their country. Right? This is their country. They go to Denver. They go to visit my father in San Francisco. They like it. They like the television shows. They don't like the food because it's tough to find kosher food. Right? But it's they enjoy it. But it's not their country. It's not their country. My son, I'm very proud of my son. Right? He chose to go into a very difficult unit in the army. Right? He chose to go to the unit because he feels it's important to have these types of units. It's important to defend the country. That's why I moved there. I wanted my kid to realize the importance of having a Jewish state and defending the Jewish state and doing it yourself and not relying on other people to do it. And one of the senses of pride I have as a parent is seeing that they've actually, you know, taken that emotion and internalized it. If he would make his bed in the morning, that would even make me more happy.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.